So on today's episode of The Statistical Life, we'll be talking about the book How to Lie with Statistics, which is a riveting read about how people use statistics to back up their own interests, and sometimes they use these statistics in a misleading way. So the intro talks a lot about how a lot of times people's realities are disconnected with what statistics actually say, and about how a lot of this is fueled by the media. They gave the example about how newspapers report on crime a lot, so it could give the illusions that there is a lot of crime. But just because a newspaper is reporting on a lot of crime doesn't necessarily mean that there's more crime. Another example was that I thought of relating to that was like with global warming. So whenever news shows talk about global warming, they'll bring on one person who is like says global warming exists and one person who says global warming doesn't exist. This warps public perception because it gives them the idea that this is something to be debated, when in fact 99% of scientists do agree that global warming is something exists. But when you're giving equal time to both arguments, you're creating the illusion that this is something that is actually up for discussion when it is really a proven scientific fact. But going on to chapter one. So chapter one is about this, is called The Sample with the Built-in Bias, and it's about like sample sizes, sample demographics, and how that can create a bias. The first example they brought up was about Yale University. In the 1930s, Time Magazine reported that the average Yale graduate makes about $25,000 a year, which is, you know, an impressive statistic, I think, at the time. It was for the class of 1924. But what the book goes on to talk about was how, well, yeah, $25,000 for the people who answered the survey. And the way the survey was done is it was mailed out. So if someone's address wasn't up to date in the mailing list, their salary was not considered. And then what the book also points out is that those whose addresses were out of date are more likely to be moving around a lot, means they're more likely to be financially unstable. For example, there's the sort of stereotype of the starving artist who's sort of living on couch to couch. Their salary would not be counted because they wouldn't have their address up to date. However, those who are rich and those who are public figures are more likely to be counted in the survey because they're more easily to contact, because they're in the public eye. What this also made me think about was I read a statistic about how UPenn has the highest amount of graduates who go on to become millionaires. And people sort of use that as evidence of UPenn being like one of the best schools. But I also know that UPenn has one of the richest student bodies. So what I think would have been a more interesting statistic to reflect like how well a college is at preparing students to enter the workforce is, what college has the highest rate of upward mobility? That is, what college has the highest percentage of students who are making more than their families did when they were being raised? Another thing they talked about was like with studies that are conducted by interviews, a lot of times something like race and gender can come into play, especially if the interviewer is in a societal position of power over the interviewee. This book is a little outdated, and they use the term Negro quite liberally, but basically they were saying like if a white man were to interview a black man and he were to ask him questions about like patriotism, it's less likely that the black man would say something that would be perceived as not being patriotic, because that they didn't want to upset the white man or cause violence to happen against them. So now I'm just going to open it up to Tian and Jasir to see if they have any comments about this. And I think, Jasir, do you have a comment? All right.
Okay, so something that I found really interesting for the first chapter was when they were talking about the surveys and how surveys, the way they give statistics, are not based on a large body of people. They were saying like if like maybe 5% of the people will actually answer the survey, and that's actually considered to be a really, really good amount. But if you really think about like if 5 people out of 100, you know, 5 people are representing, like their statistics are representing that whole 100, and it just shows you how statistics can really make you make the person they're trying to sell the information to perceive something that is not necessarily true. There was something in the beginning that I really liked as well. Hold on, where is it? Hmm. Do you have anything, Tiana, to say while I look for this?
So one of the main things that I found interesting in the first chapter was the fact that when they were talking about these sample sizes, another thing they talked about was like the selection of the interviewers when they do these things is very is a very crucial thing. And some of these like interviewers are chosen for specific reasons because they can pander to a certain demographic. That way the interview can get the answers that they want or things that they need. Another thing that I found like really interesting was like Ruby said earlier, like the like very liberal use of the word Negro. I'm not sure specifically when the book was written, but it's just kind of interesting to see that even the term was used so loosely back then. Jesse, did you find anything?
1954
is when the book was written.
So I guess concluding the first chapter, it's really interesting that the statistics, like the way statistics are advertised and given out and this certain amount of data, hasn't really changed much if we're saying 1954. And the same techniques and pretty much the same thing is being sold to us over and over, and they're still doing the same thing. And I guess now it's like maybe a bit more extreme and more intense for the population today just because of the rise in social media and technology. But overall, it seems like the same techniques are being used, and there's always going to be a built-in bias when statistics are given out.
So we're going to hear a little bit more from Jasir about Chapter 2, which is about averages and how they are chosen.
Okay, so Chapter 2 is called The Well-Chosen Average, and we learned this in class. When did we learn this? Earlier in the year, and pretty much talked about how average is such a loose word, and that's pretty much how the book opens up. It tells you that average can be used in so many different ways because there are so many different types of averages. So the book opens up talking about a landlord or someone selling a property, and the agent tells a person who's trying to buy the property that the average income in this neighborhood is $15,000, which is, you know, pretty decent back then. It's probably a well upper middle class lifestyle back then. So the person assumes that the $15,000 neighborhood is going to be a nice neighborhood. It's going to have nice property. And they emphasize that he's a snob. So I guess to say that he's stuck up, he's not really going to do his own research. You know, he feels like he has the money. He doesn't really care. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, emphasizing that he buys the house, not really caring. You know, he's a snob. They emphasize that a lot. So then it says, you know, eventually after he buys the house, later on, the person who sold him the house, who's trying to keep the tax assessments down, or tax rate down, that's the word they use, he says that they're trying to keep it down because the average income in the neighborhood is only $3,500. Now, earlier he said that the average was 15, and now he's saying that the average is $3,500. And in no way is he lying legally about that statistic, because he used two different types of averages, where it doesn't say exactly what average he used in the book, but what it does tell you that, you know, he could have used the average income for maybe the average of each person, where they added the incomes and divided it by the number of people they surveyed, where also they could have used the range, they could have used the median, they could have used so many different types of things, which would have gave you a vast ranges of different statistics. What I think is really interesting, because I know that this can happen in Philadelphia, where there are some neighborhoods where, you know, if you look at the average income of that neighborhood, it may seem really poor or really great, because there are some neighborhoods that are literally divided by streets, where there's a rich side and a poor side. And there are some neighborhoods where there's literally a property that's like worth $200,000 in like a $50,000 neighborhood, where there's just like a giant, you know, where there's people who are buying properties, fixing them up, and, you know, I guess in forms, you know, gentrification, and where they're just buying these large properties, and it's kind of like forcing the neighborhood in a different direction. And I think that I've seen that happen in many different cities in America. So, does anyone else want to say anything?
Well, I think it's really interesting about how this article or this chapter sort of like talks about how the real estate agent is like framing whether or not one would want to live in the neighborhood by the income. So he says that the average income for this neighborhood is $15,000 a year, which in 2000, this is published in 1954, so we just looked it up, and in 2015, that would be $130,000 and $885.87. That was a very strange way to say that number. But it's like an upper-middle-class neighborhood. So I guess like if one was upper-middle-class and wanted to self-segregate, then that's where they would go. I also think it was interesting just sort of taking the like American cultural context into account is that the 1950s, when this was published, was sort of like the golden age of American consumerism. And like there is a vast number of like consumer products available on the market for the first time. And like this is really when we start to see like the concept of the American dream being defined as like very specific, like living in a suburban house with a white picket fence, you know, and a two-car garage. And so like this is when Americans are really defining themselves by material wealth. And I just think it's interesting that this book is bringing that into light and highlighting that. Probably not intentionally. Well, definitely not intentionally, because that's just how people are. But I just think it's a very interesting thing to think about, especially when relating to statistics.
One thing that I found interesting with this part of the book specifically was just that there are so many different types of averages. And I'm like, just for me, it was a little bit eye-opening, the fact that they don't necessarily lie when they use these different averages, but they're just so widely like known, as Jasir discussed earlier. And the fact that like they in like some of these different kinds of scenarios, like they'll use statistics that aren't really needed. So for example, in a like a car campaign or something like that, they might use the mean of something and call that the average. And in no way are they lying, but they aren't telling you specifically what you need to know or what you would prefer to know.
Okay. And another thing that I found really interesting that I wanted to talk about is the way they talk about average income. And I can't remember who brought it up. Maybe it was you, Mr. Miles, but either way. It was when they were talking about income of a business, and they gave an example, I think it was in a worksheet, where it was like, the average income was, I'm just going to make this number up for the purpose of the point, was $50,000. And, you know, that's pretty decent, you know, it's not, well, it's pretty decent. It's like, you know, lower middle class, really, middle class. And, but anyway, what they didn't show was like how that people were, like the average person really, like the number that you would really want to know if you were taking a job, the average person was really getting paid around $20,000, and the person who was really like distorting the number was the owner and like the management, who were getting paid like hundreds of thousand dollars, like $1 million. So that shows just like how crazy just a few numbers can really divert the statistic, and how technically they didn't lie to you. That is the average income. But now we're gonna move on to chapter 3, which is the little figures that are not there, and Tian will be talking about.
So in chapter 3, which is called The Little Figures that are Not There, this chapter overall, it really just discusses how different ad campaigns and different marketing like uses statistics and the way that they warp them. The first thing they talk about specifically that I found interesting was like how the sample sizes are really small. As Ruby discussed earlier, sample sizes for ad campaigns are usually made to fit whatever is needed. For a specific test, or just like given, just they'll make a sample size specifically made for whatever is needed for their need. They also, when they talked about the probability of some of these things and how ads are using them, it's like one of the things they talked about earlier was if you're tossing a penny about 10 times, you expect it to be 50-50, but in reality, it'll get closer to 50-50 the more that you flip it, but it'll start off one way. It'll start off going towards one direction specifically. The chapter just overall, it just talks about how like some of these really irrational statistics that if they were put into full sample size and they were put out evenly, ads wouldn't be as enticing just because of the fact that they are so warped now. Anybody have any comments on that?
Yeah, I see a lot of statistics manipulated by companies. I was listening to this really interesting piece on NPR about pharmaceutical companies and how they will go every day at lunch to hospitals and like buy the doctor's steak dinner and like give them free samples of their prescription drugs and like encourage them to prescribe them to people who don't even need it. And like when a doctor prescribes a drug that to a patient, like the pharmaceutical company will count it as an endorsement, but like really, and they'll say stuff like 3 out of 4 doctors like endorse this product. But like in reality, they don't really, the doctors, like sure, maybe verbally they endorse it, but they haven't really done their due diligence in endorsing the product. And so like when companies use these statistics like that, they're manipulating doctors to push this product on consumers. And then in the commercials, they're manipulating consumers, leading them to believe that the doctors that they manipulated to say this product was good is actually good. So there's just like a lot of manipulation going on, and a lot of this is done through statistics. And I think it's so interesting how even though this book was written 51 years ago, a lot of it is, or no, not 51 years, 61 years ago, a lot of this information is still very relevant.
So I guess to piggyback off the point Ruby made, when it was like 3 out of 4 doctors may endorse this product, which is really interesting that they may not tell you that these doctors may be hired by the company, and these doctors are employed by the company, and these it literally may be 4 doctors, so literally 3 out of 4 doctors. And anyway, you know, you can really lie. Like, there are the, especially with advertising, there are the limits and grounds of which you're needed to tell the truth are very lenient, and like you can really say anything that you want, and you can pretty much say it's freedom of speech, really. So it's really hard to trust statistics, and I think for the common person, it's really hard to. I mean, it's for the common person, it's really hard for them to get the information they really need, because at the end of the day, it's really all about profits. And I'm looking just at the pictures, and a lot of them really just have to do with money. You know, there's a lot of graphs, there are a lot of things just about projecting, you know, how can we sell the message to get this person to buy what we want them, or to buy my product.
So. Yeah, you know, as they say, cream, cash rules everything around me. And I just, you know, I think a lot of times it's, like Jasir was saying, it's definitely hard for people to know what to believe. And I generally think, like, going into things, like, neutral and not going in, like, with any assumptions is the best thing to do. But obviously we all go in with our own biases and assumptions. And, like, something that bothers me a lot is when I see people, like, sharing articles on Facebook from super unreliable sources, like, one source that people who are super into like pseudoscience and anti-vaccinations, like one website people share from a lot is called like Spirit Science and Metaphysics. Have you guys ever seen that website? I really hate that website. It's full of so much misinformation. A certain SLA alum shared an article from there saying that Ebola was created by the U.S. government, and the evidence of that was that one man no one was actually getting Ebola. It was made up by the U.S. government, and their evidence was that one guy in Africa said that it was made up, and she decided that made more sense than the fact that literally hundreds of thousands of people are dying from it. So yeah, I think a lot of times people will selectively believe certain information and not others to make it fit into their own narrative. And I think for me, as someone who's like very concerned about social justice and fairness, is I think it's very important to understand that not everything fits neatly into one box, and that there are nuances to every situation, and that it's important to like be rational and to consider facts before like moving forward and making like broad brushstroke reform. So, does anyone else have anything to say? So, thanks for tuning in to This Statistical Life. This is our first episode. Next episode, we'll be talking about some really interesting stuff with statistics. So, Can't wait to talk to you.